Killer Keller podcast. Killer Keller official.com.
You need the Kellervision app. 24/7 mini documentaries, podcasts, live shows, DJ live streams, top fives, subscription packages, plus products for all your podcasts and street culture sports. Download it from the app store for free today.
Beatbox created.
Killer Keller.
And we're here to talk about world music and street culture.
Killer Keller podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, Killer Keller Podcast, live and direct, Central London. Or as central as you need to be, should be, could be, or want to be. Anywhere else, you're just wasting your time. It's too much traffic, man. Wishing everyone a good morning. Big shout out to graffitikings.co.uk. Hold tight to every regulars that have got the Kellervision app, free download, iPhone, Android. No, deal is. That's sporting art business. Inside the house. Not only have we got a really dear friend of mine, I ain't going to waste no more time minting my worms. Make some noise. Scratch pervers. Prime cuts.
Lovely to be here, man. Really nice to be here.
Wow, we made it.
Yeah,
we made it.
Finally.
We made it. How you been?
I'm all right. A little bit squiffy from last night, but celebrating Cult 45 sort of on the mend and playing at a little gallery spot in Camden for PIC.
Oh, touch, yeah. Fun, but, and Cult 45, man, that's somebody I'd love to on the podcast one day.
Oh, we'll make it happen, man. I'm going to go and see him next week. So, yeah, we had a good long chat for about an hour yesterday. And then I celebrated with about a few too many beers. So,
big shout out Cult 45. Big shout out PIC. Yeah, when I did see the Insta stories, I thought to myself, hold on, quick, send him a text message. What time tomorrow are you going to be here? I could see it was going to get wavy pretty quickly.
It was a good night. Yeah, me and Dexter spinning some tunes. It was wicked. No, Dexter from Brotherhood.
Big shout, Dexter. Listen, hold on, let's just break for a second, because I forget, you know, I've known you for the greater portion of my musical life. And you're so well deeply connected in the hip-hop thing from the... I mean, these names that you're throwing out, we never crossed paths with these characters in the time I was... You know, I've been friends with you, but these are people that you've got... You've got a life of lives, man.
I've known Cult since maybe 87. And around that time, we were just the little runts at Covent. But we were there. You know, we would hang out there, me and Kissy K, who I've known again since, like, you know, 87.
You were at Covent.
That was the year I got the name Prime Cuts from Rob Euro, gave me the name Prime Cuts in 1987. So I've had that name.
In Covent? This was...
We would go there. We weren't, like, the main players. We were just little kids. But we were there. We would go up there on Charing Cross and, you know, be around those kind of meeting spots, absorbing it, you know, experiencing it. Watching people dance and the artwork and people sharing, you know, showing books and stuff. It's, you know, I was never really in the graffiti thing myself, but I was a fan of it, you know.
And it was all around you, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I was youth culture at the time for that, you know, that growing up from like 11 to 16. It was just that, dancing, art, music.
How many people were there at Covent Garden? Because for those of you that aren't in the know, Covent Garden in its prime was it was the epicenter of street culture of its era.
Totally. I mean, it was a meeting spot, but we kind of caught it at the tail end of it happening. You know, 87, 88, it had been going strong since the early 80s, so we only really kind of experienced the last few years of it. And kind of half growing up in Kent and half growing up in London, I had links to people in sort of Stratford and Plaistow, and that was who I'd go to Covent Garden with, like Martin Gaspard and Rob Euro, I actually met Cult in Gravesend in 87, around that sort of time. And knew Arrow from that sort of period of time as well.
Tight Arrow.
Yeah. And Cell One, you know, we ended up going, forming the Gutter Snipes and stuff, yeah.
And this is where...
And First Rate, it was Blob at the time. Mm. Yeah, known those guys forever.
DJ name was Blob?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his DJ name was Blob from maybe 86 to, I think when he changed his name to First Rate, maybe around 1990, 1991.
My mind's blown. I knew it was going to be one of these ones. I just knew it.
And yeah, I'm random. I've known Random since 1990 because we both did the DMCs in 1990. I was 17 and I think he was 18.
17-year-old yeah. Prime Cuts. What was going through your head at 17 doing the DMCs?
Yeah, terrifying. I remember being in the Slammer, this nightclub where they had the region. Well, it was the region. It was like a heat. Back then they had a heat and then you go to a regional if you qualified at the heat. And me and the Edge qualified at the Slammer. But I remember being, you know, just in the club and looking at the turntables set up and just thinking, shit, man, I'm going to be up there in a minute. What on earth? Madder as well from Sun & Noise. He was involved in that competition.
Old time Madder.
So all of Sun & Noise was there. Mm. Yeah, mad. And yeah, at the Edge, I got first place, I got second. We ended up in Chippenham at Gold Diggers doing the regional. And Reckless, who went on to become the UK champion, won that heat. Yeah. And Dom Random comes second. He was reading a magazine. It was that routine where he read the magazine in a mix. Caned me by reading a mag.
That's so sick.
And I come third, so I missed out the UK finals just by that much.
Just by a crowd pleaser.
Yeah.
Them damn crowd pleasers.
But good times, man. Yeah, She Rockers were the judges that night, remember.
Man.
Yeah.
I think... Let's really go this deep into it, because the way you're talking now, we're talking like some really, really, really young Prime Cuts.
Mm, yeah, 17 in 1990, so...
That's a lot for people to take on. More so me personally, because knowing you for as long as I have and knowing that that's almost like... When I met you, it was like you were over half of your year in hip-hop.
Yeah, yeah.
That's crazy. And to think that you've created this legacy that's kind of, it just keeps moving, but you started so young.
Yeah, I mean, I got the decks in 88 when I was 16, but I've been scratching since, say, 85 is when I first started getting into scratching after sort of discovering the music and scratching via the dancing, really, because I was into dancing. And
Who was your favourite DJs that were aspiring to make you?
In 85, DJ Cheese, a guy called Cutmaster DC, Mr. Mix from Two Live Crew. I used to air scratch to the B-side of What I Like, and even now it still does me every time, that record. It's just an 808 and some cutting. It's so good. But I sort of just obsessed with it, became really obsessed with scratching. Didn't get decks until 88 and then went in for the DMCs in January 1990. But it wasn't like, you weren't on a path to a career. This was just what you did.
You didn't think like that?
No. Well, there was no kind of vision to it. It was just like you're going for the battle and it's just for the battle's sake.
It is just what you did. And because of the wealth of creative opportunity with Graf, with B-boying, with MCing and that culture and everything, you could pretty much choose a lane and change a lane whenever you wanted.
Yeah, there were many people who did everything really well. But I was into the dance and I wasn't the greatest dancer. But when I caught the scratching thing, that resonated with me. And it was like I'd be at a the local youth club, cutting on the little disco set. And there'd be like older lads who are like 19 and I'd be getting like respect from these older kids. Oh. You're like, yeah, this is it. This is what I should be doing.
I think I'm onto something here. I'm not getting beats. This is good. Yeah. It's funny what things are a catalyst, isn't it, to make you progress. See, if it's not girls, it's the fear of failing to your peers, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's that B-boy ethic of wanting to just get as good as you can be. And you know, with the DMC competition, there was a vehicle there for people to show their wares, even though there wasn't necessarily like a DJ circuit that you could go onto afterwards. It was still there was a mechanism to get your name out there.
And big up Tony as well, Tony Prince, for that. He's been on podcasts, and big up Tony. I mean, what a legend.
Yeah, the whole Prince family, very, 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 really good people. When I had to... I shouldn't tell this story, but I'm going to tell it.
Yes.
When I had to fabricate a reason for Vegas not to be able to do a tour of Japan with Banksy. So Vegas, Tony got a gig with Banksy in Japan, like early on in Banksy's career. We were managed by Time Bomb, based in Bristol, and they also managed Banksy.
Right.
So Steve has kind of commissioned Tony to go on this tour. And the morning of the flights, Tony's rung me. He's like, you've got to just get me out of this, man. I can't go. I think he'd had an argument with his missus or something. Sorry, Tone. And I've put the phone down and I'm like, what's watertight? So I've had to call the agent. So look, Tone's like, he's been really keen in it, and he's kind of had a nervous breakdown. And this information obviously filtered out to a lot of people. I had Christine Prince ring me up saying, look, we've heard about Tony, and he can come and stay at our country house. No way. And I was like, wow, what a lovely thing. I felt like complete bullshit.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh.
Does Tony and him know about that?
No. They do
now. Sorry. Sorry too. I knew it. I did.
But I thought it was just such a sweet thing of like, you know, if he needs to get out of London and clear his head and
that
stuff.
It's the coolest. That's very Elton John of them, isn't it?
Yeah.
You've known Tony Fowler?
Oh, man. I was aware of Tony before I really knew him. He was like one of the dudes who worked in Bongo and Soul Jazz. So when I was going in Soul Jazz, maybe 92, 93, he was working there. I think he was doing like a Saturday gig there. And then he was obviously in Bongos, I always associated him as being part of that, you know, that team and really being into his jazz. And then finding out that he was into scratching, it was like, yeah? Oh, man, I had no idea. It was really, really surprising.
Mind blown.
And then, you know, then he had the idea of putting together the crew. And I was initially like, nah, I've, you know, back then quite egotistical and thinking, you know, why do I want to join them?
Yeah.
But it was also because at the time, you know, you sort of drift into this thing and drift out. I had a job in Soho and was working as an editor. So I had a kind of career thing happening. So it was also like, you know, can I sacrifice time to get involved in this? And then we'd meet at the shop, and it started to gain some momentum, and it started to become, it just naturally happened. And it was, yeah, really exciting time for that kind of aspect of the culture, because there was all these new techniques coming to the front, and the technology had just leapt on with the Vestax mixers. So you had faders that could be manipulated and didn't break immediately. Mm. So you had this like new, the whole thing just got a really big push, and we were there. You know, the timing of it was, we were really lucky in a lot of ways. You know, the media were interested in it. The formation of the crew happened just at that right time. Mm. You know, being voted DJs of the year by The Face before we'd really done anything. We got that for just existing.
And the crew that we're talking about here is the Scratch Perverts, which World DMC, I'm very proud to say I'm a part of it, and the other, what, seven-man crew, but four primary four figures that then turned into a three, but prior to that it was eight. And yeah, a tour de force. Curiously though, what was your prospective future job role? What were you doing in Soho? What was your plan?
Well, I trained as an engineer, electrical engineer, and I didn't really enjoy the gig, so I went back into further education at a place called Ravensbourne School of TV and studied television studios systems engineering. And off of that, you kind of, it's such a vocational gig that you were pretty much guaranteed a job. Mm. So I got a job at this place called Paul Miller Post Production.
I'll type Paul. that's a finger sign for those that are listening.
That's for you, Paul. that was a difficult first gig to get. I worked there for maybe 18 months and just thought, fucking shit. And just decided, I'm like 25 at the time. I don't want to get to the ripe old age of 30. Thinking, you know, I could have given the DJ thing a go. So just thought, right, I'm going to, you know, have to leave the job and go for it. So in December 97, I decided to get myself sacked.
How did you do this?
Paul wouldn't sack me because Paul's an egotistical maniac, and he just promoted me to be head of CTA, the Central Technical Area. By sacking me, it was almost like an admission of him making a mistake. So I let everyone know in the company, look, I'm going to do this. It was like a running joke with everyone, turn up late, just, you know. And time again, he didn't sack me. And then I was being reprimanded for something. I can't remember what it was. I was sitting in his office, he's bollocking me for something. And I asked for a pay rise, and he sacked me immediately.
Good. All that time trying to knock him down by being late to shit. And I was, can you get a pay rise? Out the fucking
And he was
door.
Like, yeah, I don't think there's a position in this company for you anymore. And I was like, yes. He's like, well, you wanted me to sack you? Yes, I've got to go and sign on now. Yeah. Like, This isn't, he thought I was mad. He was like, there's no way you're going to succeed. You're making
you'll
a huge
never
mistake.
Make it. Yeah. I'll see it to the, you know what I mean? Door slams. And what, so was this the transitional point of Scratch Purpose, or was it, because I don't remember, in fairness and respectfully, I remember Prime Cuts, the name, and obviously Gutter Snipes. That was one of the main key. But I don't remember Prime Cuts going out as a DJ on his own entirely. I remember it was quite a crew. He was a bad. You were accompaniment to Gutter Snipes. That's how I kind of came into the film.
Yeah, I mean, I used to do a dancehall club. It was one of the first gigs I ever used to play. That was sort of 91, 92. Mm. And around the same time, I would play at the Red Lion in Northfleet, which is where the Slammer was based. Gotcha. The Slammer was like a breeding ground for some of the most amazing DJ talent at the time. So
okay, Brian Cuts, come on.
Yeah, you had Tim Westwood, Norman Jay, Giles Peterson, Pete Tong, Nicky Holloway, all these guys
who
were quite young dudes at the time. So we're talking, and I snuck into that venue in 87 when I was 15 to see CJ McIntosh. And I'll never forget, he was cutting, he had that sort of side of platter cutting thing. I managed to get myself on stage. I was mad underage. But it was an incredible spot. And I played there quite a lot, at the Brooklyn Nights and Living Easy and things at Craig and Marcus, who were like local DJs, and a guy called Carl who had an incredible record collection. So I was playing out, but it wasn't like, you know, these were like 40, 50 quidders. It was, you know, it was that kind of gig. But when the thing with the Scratch Perverts was happening, from the very beginning, we were already sort of seeped in club culture and were playing out. I mean,
clearly.
I was doing Rocker's Revenge.
Yes, that's
before,
what I didn't
remember. Just around the time me and Tony were becoming friends, and then during that summer is when he went and did the ITF. So the whole thing started to gain momentum. But I think we were quite fortunate as an outfit to be out, you know, DJing from the beginning. So when I'd left the job, I could kind of make ends meet by playing out. And then during the day, just build routines and work on new ideas.
Where'd you get your tenacity from, Joe? Like, is hip-hop the bug for you? Because to a lot of people that are listening right now, we're skipping quite an emotive perspective, because hip-hop is so you that you're talking as if it's just a given. To a lot of people, it's like, what? You were just there? You just did that? You were? What drove you?
Well, it's a demanding, you know, every aspect of that culture, of hip-hop culture, is a very demanding thing. There's no shortcut to any of it. You know, you've got to be incredibly dedicated to visit the record stores, to put yourself in danger at gigs, to, you know, frequent the places you need to frequent and put yourself in danger.
Yeah.
and just study the thing. I mean, for me, it was DJing, but it's equally true for people who are into the, you know, the dance and the art side of things. The
battling,
scene, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's that, I just love the fact that you're trading off of what you can do, and there's nothing else. It's not about it's not about your garms or your money or your flex. It's about what you can do.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that really excited me, and still does. I still, you know, even when we became a collective, you know, all the way through to, you know, me, Tony, and Neil spinning, you know, dub plates, you know, drum and bass and stuff, like, you know, producer like Scream. We were trying to outdo one another. It was kind of a battle, but we managed to figure out a way of it seeming like this united force. But we were really trying to outdo one another. And I think that kept everything energy maximum, you know, everyone wants to have the best ideas. Everyone wants to have the best tunes, the best dubs. And I think that that's it all stems from that real sort of B-boy ethic.
Makes it exciting, makes people want to be engaged. It doesn't. There's a performance aspect to it as well, which I think hip-hop DJing also brings to the sphere as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I'm quite excited by the idea of trying to apply that style to other forms of music as well. Mm. I was saying about playing that dance all night. Mm. I used to play it in the way you'd play hip-hop, so I'd hit Daddy Cool's, get like, you know, eight versions of the same rhythm on jammies, but then bash through them as if it was like, you know, just play verse, bash, verse,
like
bash.
You so
it's
would,
almost like yeah. You're pulling a rewind, but you're just... Mm. And people would go, but no, I wish I had footage of that club, actually.
Yeah.
It was a New Year's Eve, I think, going 91, 92, and people were climbing the walls. I remember thinking at the time, because there was a guy with a camera in the corner thinking, I'd love to see that.
Yeah.
I've always wondered what happened to that tape.
Oh, man, the classic hip-hop and any club nights that I remember as a kid is just... Oh. And you guys were very much a part. Tony being in the record stores, I remember ITF being the that was one of the main anchor points for DJs of, in hip-hop, especially every year.
Of course, I mean, when the Pickles did the X-Men Executioner stuff, when they, that battle happened and it was part of the ITF, I think that just, that event resonated through the whole world and beyond. I mean, I remember sharing a flat at the time with two brothers and my mate Drew in Brixton, and they were, they weren't really into hip-hop, but they would watch that battle again and again and again and again, because it's just, it's like the pinnacle of something. You're seeing the absolute pinnacle of of an art form. It's incredibly infectious.
And you guys were there at the right time, like you say. Tony came back from... I mean, there are other areas that we can obviously cover. Mm. The relationship between you and Harry, and you giving him his first, you know, pieces of equipment to mess with and stuff. Like, there's a lot of, you know, fault lines here. But from my introduction and understanding, it was almost like when Tony came... It was almost like when Tony came back from succeeding at ITF, there was always already this forward march of, well, actually, I've got a crew, and actually, this is about to happen. And actually, we're joining in with these guys over in America.
Yeah, I mean the timing of it. None of it was, you know, it wasn't some kind of kind of plan. But like when the crew, like really early on in the crew, when I was still sort of humming and hawing about whether, you know, whether to make the jump and whether what I was going to do, you know, if I was going to get involved in this thing. Mm. Paul and Mark were like this kind of double act, and they were going out and gigging and spreading the you know the name around the country at the time. They were out there. For, you know, a good 6 months to a year. And then summer 97, Tony wins the heat in New York, and I think that really changed everything.
Yeah.
Suddenly the spotlight was like, boom, it's on these guys, you know.
I got goosebumps. I can see I can't even think about that time without getting goosebumps. I was just like, oh, that was just like... Because what happened was, Invisible Scratch Pickles, they'll come over and do something. I remember Fresh 97, I always go on about, bang on about Fresh 97. But that was, for me, like... They brought it to a place that was so radically, like, different to anything that was going on. And I'll see you later, gone, and off they go.
Yeah.
They've left a massive hole, and people wanted more of it. And then I remember the following month, it must have been a month later, Concord 2, you, Tony, Mr. Thing, and First Rate, you four. Were it Concord 2 and...
I remember it. It was actually at the... It wasn't Concord 2. It was the one that was just behind the pier that's not there anymore.
The little one, yeah.
Yeah, the Concord.
Yeah, that's it.
Maybe the first, yeah.
The Knowledge Yourself nights.
Yes, yeah. That was the night... I think that was the first night I did Jack of Spades, that juggle.
Yeah.
Talking to Mex. You know, Mex?
Mex, big up Mex.
Yeah. Chatting to Mex about that afterwards, and I think I drank a bottle of vodka.
I just remember so well, man. Like, I was at the front, like... Me and my woolly hat and my baggy clothes, thinking I was so hip hop and fuck.
Yeah, it was good times, man. I mean, it was just happening, you know. It was really happening.
Mm.
And even though the Pickles, they stepped away from battling, but they were, you know, still very active, and I still get a lot of pleasure from watching D Styles cut. Still, you know, rate that guy as the greatest scratcher to have walked the earth.
Mm.
Just a very, very, very enjoyable experience. It's tinged with pain and dread as well, because you're watching thinking, fucking hell.
Do you still get that now?
Yeah, man, totally. I just, you know, if watching you know, someone who's really, really good at cutting, it's I love it, but it's also that kind of there's element of like, fuck man, I need to learn that. I've got to learn that. Mm. And I like that, because I stepped away from scratching for a while. It wasn't really currency in clubs when we were you know, bashing through dub plates and stuff around that time.
So what time are we talking?
Even though we were doing scratching, maybe from like 04 to like 10. Yeah. That period of time, it was about what the record could do to an audience rather than what you did with the record. Do you know what I mean? It was like, so the clubbing thing, yeah, we were knee deep in that dub plate thing. We would really, yeah, that was the 9 to 5. And it, when the relevance of the scratchings, yeah, when it, as it subsided, it was quite a difficult thing to deal with.
Because you guys were used to, yeah.
This is my shit, you know, this is what I do. So when...
Can't just be called the perverts.
I mean, we do still do it, but it wasn't like a thing that you would study, and I forgot the joy that you get from seeing something that's a mystery and unpicking it until it's no longer a mystery doing it and you're nailing it and you've worked that thing out. And that is, it's probably the best feeling in life, actually, to see a particular pattern and just be like, what? I don't understand that at all. And then get to a stage, hopefully only a few days later, where you've figured it out. Mm. But I'd forgotten that. And then around maybe 2011, 2012, I actually messaged Dave D-Star saying, I'm getting back into this thing. I just want you to know. He must have read it like, do you fucking care? But it was just like this big thing. I'm going to do it. I'm going to get back into it. But I've rediscovered a love for it, and I just enjoy it. And I feel like it's become a relevant thing with the technology
for sure
advancing to a stage where, you know, Paris Hilton can have a residency in Ibiza, and the culture's been so diluted. One aspect of it, you can't sync button scratching. You can't do that. Mm. You know, it's a very human thing, and I think that's why I love D Styles so much, is because when he's scratching, it's Dave scratching. It's not D Styles. It's him. You can really feel an essence of him performing.
Yes, 100%. Yeah. The clinical side to that, loving the equipment, loving the scratching. I mean, the engineering of when you were younger, being into the engineering, but also I know you as a drummer. I know you were a drummer back in the day as well. So the patterns that you do with your scratching, ultimately, as clinical as they are, I think for me personally, as a beatboxer, listening to your scratching, I can it's like patterns of drum roll kind of sharpness.
I think the... Yeah, I think the drumming thing actually helped the scratching, and vice versa, really, because I was into scratching before I got my first set of drums. Was in 92. Mm. I went and bought a drum kit from Supreme Drums in Walthamstow. Oh, if I could have a time machine and go back to that day, because they had some Gretsch jazz kits, which are now Hen's Teeth. There was like half a dozen of them, you know, £500, and now you never see that kind of snow. And there was like a drum store in Dartford, and I got quite friendly with the dude who ran it, and we used to do... I can't believe I'm saying this. We used to do...
Here's another one.
like credit card and checkbook fraud.
Who did?
Back in the day.
Fucking genius.
And I managed to... I won't say the shop's name or the bloke who owned it, but I managed to get this Gretsch kit that used to belong to... Paul Weller's drummer, Paul White. I think he got a sponsorship from Pearl.
Yeah.
And it was in there. And I remember that same week I'd driven to this other spot in Birmingham, because I wanted this particular kit. I wanted this a downbeat kit, which is what Clyde Stubblefield used. So I took this VHS tape around to all these different drum shops saying, look, what drum kit's this? Found out it was a downbeat. Drove to Birmingham to buy it, and we just couldn't get it to sound good. It was knackered. It all warped in the sunlight. So I had to drive all the way home with this cheap kit that I bought from this place in Walthamstow. It was a Premier kit, and I managed to trade in my Premier kit and a little...
For those of you who are listening and not watching, the sound self-explanatory.
It was a very, very, very long time ago.
Yeah.
So hopefully that doesn't mean...
It's past tense, all right?
Court proceedings.
Hindsight.
And a tenure in jail, yeah.
Yeah, no, you're all right, you're all right. A lot of water under the bridge. Dude, when I think of your scratching, and there'd be a lot of other people that mirror the affection that you have for these styles, but actually in you as well. Like, people, when they see you scratch, that shit is intimidating. I've seen fuckers turn around and just be like, watching, not wanting to watch. They're just there like, the fuck? You know that too. Like, what you added within UK DJing is so immeasurable, especially when you have a vehicle that comes to fruition at the perfect time, which was Scratch Perverts. All of a sudden, like you're saying, it's not a case that, oh, we'll get any Tom, Dick and Harry into the crew. Mm. No, you guys had to have been the right age, the right sensibility, the right technical ability. You know, there was so much stuff that was going on, and it was more than just right place, right time. It was just a lot of other things, wasn't it?
Yeah, and everyone had their kind of own style, you know. Mm. Everyone brought something quite unique, I think, to the table. And and you know, the reason for joining a crew is so that everyone can kind of absorb a bit from everyone else. So everyone was kind of, everything was being thrown into this kind of melting pot, and all these different techniques were coming around because there were, you know, the technology was affording you to do this stuff. So when the, like the 07, when that came out, it allowed you to do all these different techniques. And I used to build these hamster switches.
Yeah, I know.
So before...
Higgs the engineering bit again.
In lunch breaks, I'd be like taking a few boxes down to Deal Real and people, you know, flog them.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. I think, but DJ Lex got one as well. Big up DJ Lex.
Yeah, it allowed you, say, like a Technics mixer or, you know, something. It allowed you to sort of swap the input so you could have it sort of hamster style and then swap it back for juggling, sort of traditional.
Mad.
Yeah, it was that 98 routine in DMC, that winning routine that heavily uses that hamster switch, because you can see I'm going from normal to reverse, and it allowed that trick of using the cross fader and the up fader with the thumb, the kind of two faders at once trick.
Just so for you, so you're listening or not watching, so you've got the two back fingers and a thumb finger, the back finger's hitting the cross fader.
Yeah, cutting that, the fader's being cut in and out with these two
with
fingers,
the two small
and the
fingers.
Thumb's bringing the beat in and out.
Yeah,
so
and
you
the
can
kind
of go diddle 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 and boom, cat, boom, cat, and...
Yeah. Right, got you, so the thumb is doing the up fader, basically.
Yeah. Okay. So, and you can only do that if it's the wrong way around. You can't do it the other way. And the Euro Scratch, you can only do that with a...
I was just going to come to the Euro... So this was around the same time as Euro Scratch. And again, this is Rob Euro coming up with the Euro Scratch.
Yes, this was... Well, Rob, I think Rob, that's 99, Rob came up with it. He rung me up, you're like, oh, come up with a new scratch pattern. Yeah. Really?
A whole new one.
And he's like, no, seriously. So I got in the car, drove to Brighton, and he's showing me. I'm not joking. When he was shouting, I literally pushed him off the decks. Get off. Let me try that. And it's just one of those really, like, very, very lucky things of the timing of it. Again, it was like, it's just before battle season.
Mm.
And for some reason, you know, it was a natural movement for me to do. And... yeah, bless Rob. Give me my name and a nice mechanism to battle A-track later in the year. So in the Hawaii battle kind of lent heavily. The outro of that battle was Euro Scratch.
Oh, you got that, like, big up, Rob Euro.
Yeah, man.
Jeez, come up with a scratch. What the fuck? Technical abilities... The trade-off of Euro scratching and whatnot, you know, all at the right time. Meanwhile, in the background, there's Harry Love, and you know, in equal generosity, you're kind of nurturing him with new pieces of equipment and trying and testing things out. Am I right in thinking that? Was that kind of the order of the day?
Yeah, I mean, Harry was he was there from like really early on. He joined maybe later than me, but it was all within such a short time frame. If you're looking back,
this is all within,
you know, this is like a kind of 6 months thing. And I think Harry from a very early stage was really tuned into making beats, and I think that's the path he, you know, he was naturally going to follow. So the crew didn't, you know, the crew was all about battling. That was it. We were a battle, that was the whole reason for us forming. So I think by the end of sort of 99, people were kind of moving in slightly different directions, whereas for me personally, I still saw it as this kind of pure battling entity that did happen to go out and, you know, gig at the weekends and earn a living from it. But the vision was to just keep that going, and, you know, we wanted to win the team thing for a second time, in 2000 and worked very, very hard on that routine. And would have. It would have been nice if we'd have won that. That means we would have been sitting on three victories rather than two. But we fucked it. So that year Crazy A-Track won it. But the year before New York, year after we formed the Perverted Allies with Crazy and Infamous.
That's right.
That all happened the week of 9/11 as well. That was a crazy, crazy
wow.
time.
Wow. That feels a long time ago, don't it?
Yeah, we were rehearsing at Tony's when that happened. So we're seeing that all unravel with two guys from America and Greg from Shaw Needles, who knew lots of people who worked in the sort of financial district of New York. It was a very, very strange experience.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Life things, isn't it?
Mm.
You mentioned that did you say 6 months? That all this kind of thought, so with Harry.
Well, you're saying, the timeline of it is like kind of the formation was sort of, people were aware of one another for years. I mean, I knew Paul from like 88. Mm. I went and visited the borderline when he battled the enforcers, and that was 1994. So we were all aware of one another for some years before the crew sort of formed 96, 97. Mm. And then I downed tools at work at the end of 97.
Right.
So for me personally, 98 was the year that everything changed because it allowed me to, I turned my 9 to 5 into DJing. That was what I was doing. So when I was at home, that was all I did for that year was prepare for the DMCs.
Crazy, isn't it?
And we had the team ITFs against the Junkies and... Yeah, you can't. I've got the gig diaries going back to this time. Mm-hmm. So you go through it and you sort of see there's this happening, then this happening, then 2 weeks later this is happening. It's like, man, how do we get all this done? You know, the week me and Paul played the opening weekend or the second opening weekend of Fabric, and then at the same time,
weekend of Fabric.
Yeah. I did an interview for one of their anniversaries maybe a year ago.
Mm.
And I was saying to Michelle, my missus, I was like, I'm going to go through the gig diaries and find out how many times I've played the club because I reckon it's going to be like quite a lot going through, because I've got the every month for 15 years. So at that time I played 158 times, 158, and I've now played 159. 159
wow.
times. Yeah, and
a lot of people can say that. They don't look after their schedules,
The last one was funny because all the security's changed and I'd been there for 6 months or whatever and it was a different team on the door. And I just turned up in my bag and my mixer and stuff and the lady that was doing the security, sort of doing a pat down thing, and I didn't have ID. She's like, "You haven't been here before, have you?"
Mm-hmm.
I was like, "It's funny you should say that. This is actually the 158th time I've played her." And she just laughed at me. She just laughed at me.
That's hilarious. Fabric's got to that point now where that is a thing, isn't it? Like the turnaround of people over the decades has been to that extent that you can't possibly have them all playing still. It's impossible, isn't it?
No, we worked there regularly for 15 years.
Mm.
Yeah, on a monthly basis. I mean, that's...
unheard of, isn't it?
That is, personally see that as an equal, if not bigger, achievement than winning some of the competitions. To do that, to remain in that environment.
And be able to sit here and tell the story.
Yeah.
What was it like? Because obviously the dynamics, you mentioned the first time that you played Fabric was with First Rate Paul.
Yeah.
Dynamically, the four of you, and this was the interesting thing as a punter before anything, was the idea that you guys could break away and have these different, almost like fractions, and then go and do multiple shows across a weekend. That really stirred up the name and built the brand.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, every weekend there was six dudes going out and gigging. Very rarely, in fact, almost never, the four of us, other than in a competition, or you say when we did the thing for Knowledge Yourself. Mm. But it was mainly sort of two-man outfits going out. So you'd have... over time, it naturally became Paul and Mark, me and Tony, and Kev Renegade and Harry Love. Those are the duos going out and doing it. But if you look through the gig list, there's lots of PC, Plus One, PC, Harry. I mean, it all sort of... there was no rhyme or reason to it. It's just whoever the promoter wanted to book, that was who was going to come do the gig. It wasn't like it was a choreographed thing. But it was, we were in that fortunate position to be able to go out and earn a living from that while preparing for a DMC or an ITF.
And that's what's crazy. Because when you think about it, as and it's, maybe it's just the romantic b-boy in me, but the whole idea of like, you have your, you have the training ground of DMC. No, you have the training ground of club nights, really. But then when it comes to DMC, you're that's the Gladiator Arena. And, you know, all the team comes together like Voltron, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, no, we're going to do this. We're really doing it because we ain't just about doing a circuit thing. You know, we're just building our brand. But when we come together, that's where you show and prove. I love that idea.
Yeah, and we used to practice, we'd practice in my flat in West Norwood. And so the four of us would be in this little room that there was no kind of like neighbouring person. There was like a stairwell to the left and then my living room to the right.
Right.
And the lady downstairs, this old lady, bless her, she was deaf. So she couldn't hear and we didn't disturb anyone. We would make a racket for like 8 hours, non-stop trying to figure out how are we going to, you know, how are we going to make this clothes stubble field pattern? And it would be hellish
to live
next door to that. So we were very fortunate to have a spot to rehearse. And then I think when we got closer to the battle, we actually hired a rehearsal space in Croydon. So we'd get that kind of sense of being at a gig rather than being in someone's living room. And you would have wedges set up, speakers, so it would feel like we were on stage. So we prepared for, you know, the sort of stage experience in New York. And got Cell One to do the as the Allies come in to land, he was the one who did the voiceover for that. And I went and had to cut the dub plate down at transitions. So we've
really?
I've still got it at home. So we did that kind of like with the noise of the plane coming in, shot the plane down, dissed every member of the Allies, and it worked. You know, it worked in New York. We kind of did a New York centric routine. And after the experience in London at the Subterranean, that was a good feeling.
Yeah, we'll get to Subterranean in a bit, but just behind me right here is the new mic mixer that you gave me in New York. You gave that to me.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Where's the rest of it?
Well, I like to think my skills would be to tell the rest of it a new arsehole, but no, it's just... No, you gave me that because there was obviously four of you and then this fifth one was around and you were like, well, you're in the crew, you have it.
Wow.
And I was like, yeah, wow. I didn't do shit and I got one.
But you wooed New York, man. You were like, you were the toast of the town, man. Mm. You guys went and killed the Roxy, right?
Yeah.
Killed it.
Killed it. Five as well. You know the one, it was you, First Rate, and Vadim, actually, they were all adamant and like, you pay your fucking flight over there, we'll do the rest. Like, Tony Prince will love you. And we'll just do it. So I put all the money down on the flight. I ended up staying in a hotel room with First Rate, you know, across the road from McDonald's. We were there most morning, evenings and afternoons. But I got the money paid back by Tony Prince.
Because
I did the two shows.
Of course, yeah, but you perform, right? Yeah.
So who dares?
Oh, well, that's good. That's
thanks
good.
To you guys, you know
that's
I mean?
Good.
I remember that day leading up to the evening of DMC, you guys had, I mean, listen, this what they do is legit. Back then, you had the decks all in the hotel room. So shit.
Man.
Like, you know, it was just a fucking, it was a DJ's heaven. And then come the evening, I remember there was a lot of delays in the lineup, as usual. Which you would get
yeah, in. You know what? I don't remember any of that. I remember having to cart six turntables in flight cases back when you could actually do that. I mean, you couldn't do that now. It would cost you thousands. So we've all taken a pair of turntables each, or, you know, enough for six, and we're rehearsing. And I remember that they didn't announce the winner until the following day, and having that sense of, like, whoever are they going to announce, and in second place, because that was when you knew. And when they said the Allies, all of us were like, oh, shit, we got it.
I remember it so well.
And then when we flew... When we flew home, I don't know if someone in the baggage area of New York Airport caught wind of the fact that we won in America and we were travelling home, but the decks got destroyed on the way home, all six in-flight cases got completely smashed to bits. It was like being on the conveyor when they came out. It's just, but no one gave a fuck because it's like we've won. We're the world champions. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Yeah. So we. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't remember that. Did that happen?
Yeah, that happened. That happened.
Wow. I don't remember.
Yeah. Maybe it wasn't all six. It was just mine.
Yeah.
Getting home and it's like there was dents in the flight case and the turntable was just. Mash up.
But I do remember, and I think I brought this up with Mr. Thing on the podcast, the John Peel was pretty much 4 days after we landed or something, wasn't it? We went and did his 60th birthday.
Yeah, do you remember that? Yeah, bless him. Man, that was, what an experience.
That was crazy.
He was hammered as well, do you remember?
Absolutely. I was just so, done in by the amount of people that were there. I think I just stuck behind you guys the whole fucking time. I was like, you know what I mean? Because at that time, I think I was about 18, 19, and I didn't really have a great care for music in the same way as I did once I was in it.
Right.
All I knew was, as a scraggly-haired hip-hop head, you guys were gods to me, and all this lot, I didn't know whether it was Joe Wiley or whatever. I didn't, none of that mattered to me because I was just so immersed in hip-hop. You guys were it. You'd fucking one of the MCs. We're playing. Of course we're doing John Peel. It was just a given, you know?
Yeah, that was just... I don't remember the glitz and the glamour. I remember that we didn't prepare. So we just kind of we ended up having to kind of really wing it. And John announcing us as being shit hot.
Yeah.
That was just I'm not going to forget this one very... Because I grew up on his show. It's like, I used to listen to his show as I fell asleep. I was a huge fan of him.
Mm.
And having, parents that were into music and would take me to gigs and stuff. And he was a respected person for years and years prior to that happening. Mm. It was a real big deal for me. I feel like he was like part of my, youth experience, really. Mm. He kind of held my hand a bit with music and would play with such a kind of honesty, there was no bullshit about him at all. It was just like, I'm going to play you this and it's going to blow your mind. It's an irreplaceable force, I think, in music.
And to think that you played his 60th, but that must have been a coming of the homes, you must have been like...
Yeah, it's all a bit of a blur now, but at the time it was just like, say, you're talking, 98, 99, it was this, then this, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened. It's like, it was there was so much going on. I'm very pleased I kept those gig diaries because you wouldn't believe, to look at it.
I'm surprised you did. I'm surprised you were. So in a real kind of Bob Monkhouse kind of way, you've kind of collected all the... Do you know what I mean? You've amassed all the, legacy that you did at that time.
Yeah, I'll show the kids at some point. Now, if they don't believe me, it's like, I've actually, this is living proof that this dad did this.
It really was this.
Dad actually did this.
Unless you really were. right, so you and Tony, as of that point, you're like two-headed monsters, you guys. Like, the moment, Rockstar doesn't even come into it, man. Like, you guys were, you trailblazed DJing, and all of a sudden, you guys were fucking way cooler than fucking Liam and Noel. All of a sudden, you were just like, all of a sudden, it was just like, yo, you guys are on the tabloids. You guys are like superstars, and you walk at 8 o'clock. It's not that, John Peel, big up, but you ain't Tony and Joel. From a rock and roll standpoint, you guys were going in. Like, it was almost like no holds barred. You were going in.
Yeah, I think we enjoyed ourselves maybe a bit too much. I think me and Tony are quite similar characters, and I think... I mean, I count him as one of my best friends now. I speak to him, almost every day.
Big up, Tony, of course.
And, that kind of realisation early on that this, this is someone I kind of have an awful lot of love for as a friend. And I think that friendship sort of tied us together quite early on in the crew's sort of formation. And ideas as well, when we were sharing ideas and trying to think of different ways of, manipulating a mixer or, when we were getting ready for ScratchCon and having a conversation with my dad initially about feedback and how we're playing... the Fillmore after party, and my dad saying,
that's bonkers.
That's a real famous Hendrix venue. Then we were talking about Hendrix and him manipulating the guitar and feedback, and it just sort of
set
this thought process off in my mind of like, I wonder if you could do that. And when Tone came around, we were practicing for, I can't remember what, we were probably getting ready for ScratchCon. And I remember talking to him and saying to him as I was doing it, perhaps if you feed the mixer and you put it in the back and that, and both of us were like, oh shit. And that was the take it off at ScratchCon. That was how it happened. It was a there and then thing. It was like immediately awesome.
That's some rock and roll shit. That just pushing them buttons up to feedback. Like you would...
Yeah, it was just take the headphone out and put the headphone in, but because of the nature of the Vestax mixer allowed you to change the kind of pitch of the feedback depending on how much you feed into itself. So you could get these kind of different tones, and that's why we ended up with that kind of siren noise at the end of the routine. And it got, yeah, it's a standing ovation, man. I'll never forget it. We were in this really quite intimidating situation of real kind of hardcore Scratch fans, and did this thing of taking all the records off.
You had to do something,
and showing,
take it off. Yeah, I remember this. Yeah.
Yeah, if you watch the D Styles and Qubit showcase, which is incredible, incredible. It's still mind blowing. But you will see Qubit at the very beginning, Qubit is shaking his head like that. And it's because we've just finished. And we just finished doing that feedback routine. And he was like, nah.
Big up, Q.
Yeah, that was a mad
everything
mad visit.
That, listen, from a UK point of view, and obviously, you know, there's levels of feedback of and resonance of, like, things that you're doing within an island, people getting super excited about it. And being the capital, or at least the entry hole to Europe as being the PR capital, your world was your oyster at that stage. You throw things like technical ability into the mix, untouchable. It's like Eddie Van Halen. It's like you can't bottle that.
Well, it's a timing thing. It's like that, you know, that came at just the right time. I mean, you could argue that we should have not done it at ScratchCon. We should have waited until the DMCs. So there was a bit of a conversation as to whether we should actually showcase it, because we kind of showed our hand to Craze and Infamous. Like, and that's, you know, but I'm glad we did it. I'm really glad we did it there. And it was so amazing to be flown over there by the Bickles to be involved in the whole thing. It was incredible. Incredible.
Bonkers stuff. Rockstar business. How well did it get? Because I hear stories, obviously, we've had a couple of podcasts now, things like DJ Prime Cuts in an airport and just buying a Rolex. You know, if you were to really epitomize to the degree of rock star it became, tell me the most wildest story you say to yourself, shit, did I really do that?
Yeah, the watch thing was obviously, it was a real, you know, I got really into timepieces like some international travel and a few drinks in the bar, and then sort of hatching the idea, oh, well, I'll go and have a look at some watches. And then the next thing, you've sort of spent $5,000 on a timepiece that you then have to take on tour. The whole tour with you. When it all kicked off, we were still, we were young men. It was like
27, 26?
Yeah, 20, 25, 26, 27. Obviously, Harry was markedly younger than us, but everyone in the team was roughly the same age. I think Mark was a year younger, maybe, or exactly the same age as me. Tony's almost exactly the same age as me. He often reminds me of the fact I'm 3 months or 4 months older than him. But it was, we got stuck in, man. We really, really enjoyed every aspect of it. And managed somehow to dance that kind of merry dance of debauchery and focus. You know, you have to focus, you know, getting ready for the ITF in 2000. That was like a 3 month intense time for me, just 12 hour shift in it, trying to figure out a way of maintaining that title after winning it in 99.
Did it ever get a lot? Because like you say, the dance. I think anyone that's exceeded, has surpassed their own expectations, or at least hit hit a peak of, you know, success, they've all experienced that dance. But when you've got a couple of opportunities, like, I've got to go on stage and the variables are nuts, the record could skip, I could just be hungover. But you know what I mean? That's a real hard dance when you've been practicing so long, but then, you know, doing a lot of extracurricular stuff at the same time. It's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, one of the early gigs we did was supporting the Beastie Boys at Brixton Academy, and Tony was destroyed. It was so bad. Sorry, Tony.
Told
but
you.
But when we're all side of stage, right, who's going to go on first? Tony's like, I'm going first. And I'm just thinking, fucking hell, how's he going to... And he nails it. He absolutely nails it.
Even though he's hungover.
And even he was in such a state. I mean, we're all feeling quite worse for wear. We were on right at the very end of the night as well. It wasn't like we didn't play before. We played afterwards. But the executioners were there. The Pickles were there. It was a mad. And I remember Joe Sinister coming up to me after I'd done my routine and said, you must go in for DMC this year. And that really lit fire in the belly, because it was like, okay, I'm getting a little nod here from someone who I've, you know, been studying his beat juggling for years.
I mean, badass.
That theme from SWAT Juggle is still one of my favourite things ever to come out of this thing.
What did you think when Tony came on a podcast here?
I thought it was good. I thought it was good, yeah. Honest, long interview.
Like I said, it's a double. You know, you guys were like some double-headed dragon. And it was, and I when he first came on, I thought, well, this one about the cat and mouse pigeons, isn't it?
Well, you know what? I love Tony. I think he was just too, just very sort of humble. Fuck that, you know. Yeah. The kid would, that whole thing that he did in that time, it's very easy to see some of these techniques and it's a given. You know, it's very easy to see that there's like a kind of, you know, you see someone execute something where they're actually concentrating on the up faders, or that was something that he brought
1000%
to the table in 97. And
yeah,
it can't be overstated how revolutionary that shit was. Mm. It was like some completely different approach to this thing.
Especially being an English guy, just going into the American...
Yeah, turning up in a fisherman's hat and a Ben Sherman and sandals, you know. Yeah. Everyone was like, who's this dude? Mm. He's cosmic. Mm-hmm. And he's just going to take every motherfucker out. Like, it was, yeah.
He doesn't get his, yeah, like you say, I think there's a humbleness to it, which is obviously endearing. But then you lose, you know, these important conversations, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I've never been one to sort of sit there and think I haven't got my props for X, Y, and Z, because it's, you know, it's all there. It's all historically there. Everyone knows, you know, you can see it in the videos and the competitions and the titles, you know, four world titles. I'm really, you know, proud of that legacy.
Four world titles, you know.
Yeah, two scratching and two teams.
Yeah.
You know, and facing some, you know, facing A-Track, man, it's no joke.
Madness.
No joke. But it's, and the following year in LA, it was an amazing experience. Me and Neil went and did that together.
So we got Neil plus one.
Yeah, plus one. We shared a hotel room with... this isn't a sexist thing. This was actually like a military
exclusive,
kind of
exclusive
thing. But I would have kind of erotic images around the practice area.
Of course.
To keep the testosterone levels high. So everyone was just like, ugh.
Yeah, man, absolutely. Listen, that's no joke. I do that. I did that. I used to do that in the studio all the time.
But it was, yeah, we were in the same hotel as Shaggy as well. So we met Shaggy at the hotel. It was quite a mad one as well. Yeah, man. But wicked memories, man. And it's funny looking back and still, I can still sense that kind of, just a degree of confidence that I had in myself that I felt like I owned the venue that night. It's like that, this. I'm having this. I'm taking this time.
I'm really
home.
Doing
I'm
this.
I'm taking this home for a second time. Put myself through the mill really to prepare for it. But you can't. You know, it's that thing of looking back and just thinking, "Wow, man, did we really do that? Did we really manage to do that?" Yes.
Bonkers. You mentioned Neil Plus One. Of course, each one of the Scratch Perverts of the early noughties formation just all held such identifiable, charismatic, personal skills and performance. You know, visually and you know technically.
Yeah, Neil was and still is. A very, very, a great mind when it comes to arrangement and presentation. He had, I mean, his routines were like pieces of music thought out and presented as such, so everything would lead to the next bit. Very, very good, very, very good at that.
And Mr. Thing, of course, with the funk, the real loose, Jazzy Jeff, that kind of trusted funk.
Yeah, and an incredible beat collector and enthusiast of all music, you know. And it was that dude from the get-go. He was an obsessive digger from the very, very beginning. And it's wonderful to see he's doing great for himself, man. I still need to visit your record shop. I still need to make that trip to the coast.
Yeah. I'm first rate with the... even saying his name, I can just picture him now on the decks and just the no fucks given. You know, these don't have to be decks. He's coming at you with whatever. He's just on you, man.
Very fond memories of like that night at the Borderline. As sort of, again, it's sort of tinged with a feeling of like, I want to be on stage and being part of this, but I'd stepped away from DJing for a bit in 94 and then got sort of drawn back into it via, you know, Gutter Snipes and Cell One. But watching that battle was something else. It felt like the torch had been passed, maybe slightly reluctantly, but it felt like something had shifted.
This was the Enforcers.
Yeah, so there was and there was other. I think there were other Madder. He was in that competition as well.
First Rate was just he
was a real force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, I felt like he, although you know it was Tony's crew and. You know, the debates I knew where the name came from. I certainly felt like Scratch Perverts.
I thought Theo came up with the name.
Perhaps it did.
I thought it was Theo, Fake Blood.
Fake Blood did it.
Yeah.
Big up Theo.
Yeah, I think I'm... Because, like I say, it was a collective of people based around Bongo first, and then it became more and more serious. And then, like I said, the tail end of 97, kicking the job and stuff.
And the Enforcers, that became quite a notorious kind of back and forth, didn't it? From what I remember, being a punter in the crowd.
Well, they were the dudes before us. It was like they were winning competitions and rocking clubs and stuff in the years prior to us existing. Mm. So
and rightly so, big up Pogo.
Big up all of them.
And
Johnny. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was quite mad, actually, to end up in a competition against them, Subterranea, where we thought we were the people's favourite, and we realised very quickly we weren't.
What happened?
Night. Oh, it just unravelled a little bit for us. It was like it wasn't the most sort of friendly audience for us. We ended up coming second, I think, but we still managed to qualify. But that was a mad night. That was a real crazy, crazy mad night. I've tried to forget about it actually ever since.
It's funny, isn't it, how that kind of people's choice thing. It quickly adverts to someone. I guess everyone has their time in the sun. And more so than most genres and cultures, hip hop and music, tend to have this thing where it's like, no, you're not Flavor of the Month this week. No. No matter what you do, we're not listening to you. We're not hearing you. No, we're not friends with you this week. And then all of a sudden you do something different. And all of a sudden it's like, yeah, you're back on schedule.
Yeah, it's quite a British trait, that that kind of building up and then breaking back down. I don't know if I would say that happens so much in hip hop culture or in general. I think you're judged on your performance and what you do. And I think that was something that when the crew began to work as an entity and a group of people coming together and sort of sharing ideas, the whole thing kind of accelerated.
Were you ever together in those situations where you did feel like the chips were down? Because, you know, band situations like bass, guitar, drums, like they often, that makes you stronger, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the first team competition we went into, we were facing the Junkies. I've got to say, that's probably my favourite battle memory.
The Junkies, brother.
It's, you know, that thing of, you know, you're facing these people who you've been studying for the last sort of few years, and when we'd done our routine and I think we pulled it off quite well, I could sense that they were like, right, we're going to really have to go for this. And stand inside a stage and like, Melody's giving me the finger, and it's like, yeah, man, this is what it's all about, man. This is actually a fight. We lost ultimately, but it was just a sense of like, we're on the same stage as these dudes, you know, J-Rock, Romantic, Babu, Melody. It's like, these guys were kings, man. And it was, their routine has really aged well. Actually, as I checked it out the other day, it still sounds superb. Yeah, Amsterdam 98, that was.
Apparently, that was the only time they actually did come out of the US. I don't think they took a venture any other time since. That was only Amsterdam they went to, and I think they were all stoned at the time. So really, that tells me they didn't really remember much of the whole trip.
Oh, man. It's such an incredible concern they've got going, man, the Junkies, and that whole school thing happening. It's just been a fantastic thing to see. Such a positive thing happen around this kind of DJ culture, and seeing those guys continue to smash it is fantastic, man.
But you guys had that too, and again, every single battle, lose or win, it just felt like there was a machine, a trusted, a belief between all of you that you were, that doesn't matter, keep going.
Oh, 100%, 100%. And you know, certain things you to get the nod in Hawaii was a super super big deal. I was convinced that A-Trap was going to win that one because of the judging panel. You just naturally feel like you're a bit of an outsider. You know, Mike Shortcut, executioners on the judging panel. It's like, I know A-Trap's Canadian, but he was like the golden boy at the time, and you just think, there's no way I'm going to get the nod on this. But to win that was just an incredible feeling. And then coming home and just all this other stuff happening in tandem, you know, the opening week, we're talking about a few weeks apart from the opening weekend of Fabric to the Hawaii battle. It's like, one was in October, one was in November. And then some other kind of biblical thing happened in December, January. It's just, mad.
Funny, again, to bottle it, that's just... I'm sure this happens more often than not because there is a refined way of doing things now, especially with the whole extra arm of social media. I'm pretty sure, you know, many fires are set and then you can control them, manipulate them, you know, like good managers do. But at that time... You guys weren't even managed, were you, at that time?
No. I mean, I don't think we were manageable, to be honest. I don't think it would have been a possible thing. I think that was one of the, you know, for me personally, was one of the reasons for changing the format of the crew, was just to get an element of control over the whole thing. And that's, you know, it's definitely a very selfish thing to have done.
So, okay, hold on one
but
second.
It was...
One second, let me just interject there just for one second. So, because I remember coming... I was there. I think I was in the crew for no more than like 8 months tops, from what I remember. And I remember that conversation arising where there was going to be a reformation. Something was going to change. There was going to be a breakdown of. I mean, for me, it was like, well, that's cool because I'm in Rocksteady now, and not to mention, I wasn't in for that long. Was that part of the theory behind it? You wanted it to. Your idea was to kind of make it more manageable.
Yeah, I think it was from a personal point of view, it was just to have a degree of control over the situation. And it was, definitely, especially in the case of Paul and Mark, was an unfair decision and pretty brutal. But, you know, the 27-year-old me at that time saw the direction of the crew. You know, this is a battle crew. We want to continue battling. We want to continue winning competitions. And that was where my head was at the time, and it felt like we needed to, you know, shrink this thing down to just two people. And that happened at the very end of that year, yeah, 99, going into 2000. Mm. And then fast forward to maybe summertime, I think, of 2001, we asked Neil if he wanted to rejoin the crew. And then it was that format for, you know, the whole of the sort of 2000s. Mm. And then Neil was started doing the stuff with Jack Beats, and then I think he and Benny probably didn't see the success coming that they were going to have. That whole thing just blew up.
Yeah, that's true, that blew as well. Because from a punter, and I think Neil, I speak to Neil about it quite a lot, I get what you're saying, because Mr. Thing was very much on the beat thing. He was doing production. He was also going out on road with Vadim a lot as well. There was a lot of things going on that were taking away, like you say, the battle to be the best in the arena. And First Rate was also doing the Monkey Mafia stuff. He was doing the Us Three and a whole bunch of other
Everyone was double busy. It wasn't like everyone was just sort of thrown on the scrap heap and nothing was going to happen for anyone from that moment. Yeah. I think everyone was already very established in their own right, as well as being part of the team.
I don't think anyone could have foreseen the explosion that, because what was like, oh yeah, we're crew, we're going to do the battle thing, suddenly became you were all like four nights every weekend.
Yeah. The club thing was absolute godsend, because it was a way of keeping financially stable while going in for the competitions, not having to hold down like a day job, because it affords you a lot more time to practice at home.
Renegade was also on some whole other, you know, he's always been a staple of the, you know, worldwide hip hop scene, and was obviously the Son of Noise stuff, and Harry with the beat productions. Mm. Like you say, I think lent a lot more towards the, maybe not entirely by choice, but he was always so naturally gifted at being a producer. But can you imagine, like, I mean, this is obviously like the fan in me again, but to have all of us form in a formation again, the idea of like just being able to facilitate every single bit, because I did feel like I missed a Scratch Pervert album, or you know, the Beat Junkie school of something could have a Scratch Pervert school. There's so much shit that could have been done. Within that meeting, I thought, oh man, that's the only thing I can't, you know, the personalities that were there. This was like boy band level charisma. Each one of you had the thing and contributed in different ways. And it just felt like at that point, when that went, I thought to myself, oh, I wonder how they're going to do an album now. That's the first thing I thought.
Yeah. I mean, me and Tony were offered a record deal by OM Records when we did the Deeper Concentration tour. Chris offered us $35,000. And 6 months to live in San Francisco and make a record. But at that time, it was probably where we were in our personal relationships as well, and where we were sort of within the kind of competition thing, that it just felt too soon to do that, because we would have had to have immersed ourselves. I mean, it could have been an incredible thing to have done, but it just felt, the timing just wasn't quite right, because it was to be given that kind of offer was incredible. Mm. And I really like Chris from OM. He's a lovely guy, but we turned it down because we were in the competition thing, and we were so dead set on that. And the idea of like making a record wasn't really on the agenda. We were just about battling, and that was that. And I think that was, you know, that's ultimately what led to that decision. And then as things have continued, the club work became more and more of an important part of the gig. We did actually have a manager in sort of from about 2004 or 5.
Yeah, I remember this.
Claudia, she was looking after us for a while, but I think she had a vision of trying to turn us into a kind of a UK version of NERD, and it didn't quite happen.
Oh, in a production sense?
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah.
I could see that. People don't, it's, as a fan, as any fan would be, you know, you see it from a, you know, second, you're not living in the moment, and it's really hard, because I know that feeling when, God, can you imagine trying to navigate 8 people with 8 separate lives, 8 separate skill sets, 8 separate gig schedules, etc. And you had no management.
Mm.
You know, and someone had to steer the boat. Whoever it could have been, it wasn't the best of managed things to even think about doing an album. That's like...
Yeah, it was. I mean, that just impossible. Wasn't... Yeah, it wasn't. And it wasn't... That wasn't why the crew was formed. We didn't form to make a record. We formed to bow. Mm. And that was what steered the boat, was the competition and the fact that when you get to the tail end of the year, you're going to have the ITFs and the DMCs and you're going to do it individually and you're going to do, you know, first wave did the scratch in ITF in 98. I did the scratch in ITF 99. We did the team 98. Mm. We did the team 99. We did the ITF team in 98. That was what steered the ship because you were focused on that and that alone and being able to go and get larruped in a club was a bonus.
Oh yeah, we done gigs together too. I remember that. Do you remember, was it Gatecrasher we did in Sheffield?
Yeah, NY Sushi. That was what we did. That was it. And I remember talking to you in the lift saying the trick for you is going to be capturing that energy you have on a slice of wax. You remember All I Know was like the joint at the time.
Yeah,
the Razelle record was that would smash it at the time, trying to kind of encapsulate that energy, capture it. Yeah, man.
Yeah, they were some good days. Obviously we've had like pretty much, I mean, bar one, which I'm still working on, we've had all the guys. Renegade, yeah. Harry, Mark, Mr. Thing, and Tony. A lot of things been said. It's all been said. You know, there's really not a lot else to go on. Other than, what's your personal feeling? What's your any regret? What's your thoughts now at the age you are in 2020?
Well, first thing I'll say is I have an awful lot of love and respect for every person involved in the crew. The decision that we made at the tail end of 99 was a brutal one, but one that at the time felt justified. You know, on reflection, I think it was, you know, it was a bit fucking harsh. But we managed to keep going. Everyone managed to keep going. Not in a kind of battle sense. Everyone went on a slightly different path, and everyone is still alive.
Yeah. Which may not have been the case if you kept on the way he was going.
But it was, yeah. I'm not a regretful person. I don't regret anything. It's like, you know, it's something that happened a very fucking long time ago.
It was a long time ago.
But I'm proud of the fact that I spoke to Harry just a few days ago. We were talking about, he's looking at getting a new mixer, and he's sort of, we were chatting about, you know, what the stuff that's on the market and what he wants to achieve, and we're even like flirting with the idea of some kind of DJ school thing. I talk to Tony every day about his desires to buy a flat in East London.
Still,
because he's, I'm like his property assistant.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
On a regs. Cheers, Tony. And yeah, I bumped into Mark in Peckham maybe a year ago. It might even be longer than that, when Ghost Notes was still happening at Levels. And I've got a lot of love and respect for him, and Kev and Paul, who I haven't seen or spoken to Paul since the split, which is quite bizarre. But yeah, I would imagine if we were to meet up, everything would just, you know, start off from where we left off.
It's kind of what I'm thinking, because, you know, I know that you guys talk. I know that it's business as usual behind the scenes. It's like you guys are all mates, and it's obviously time's healed, and it's why we're even all able to do podcasts. But I think as a punter, as somebody who's outside and doesn't actually know the ins and outs and the weekly, monthlies, would we ever see a Scratch Perverts reunion? That's what everyone asks me.
The door to my studio is always open to everyone in the team, yourself included. In fact, I think we might even be popping down there
soon. That's actually going to happen, yeah.
So, I mean, let's see if we can, you know, if we could do something, that'd be sick.
Do you reckon they'd be up for it?
I think everyone is, it's lovely to see everyone's quite busy, but it's... We live in a time where you can can realise an idea and bring something to fruition quite quickly. The fact that you can share music immediately, the moment you've made it, you can whack it on Bandcamp. The mechanisms have changed for putting stuff out. You know, in lockdown, I did this Dead Hand project with Mark Broom and James Ruskin, who were these kind of techno stalwarts, two wicked, wicked producers. But we did it in isolation. We never actually met. We just send in, you know, music and scratching and made an album, you know. And so if you can, if that can be done in, you know, but it would be, I would like to see Paul. I haven't seen him for a very, very long time. So, yeah, shout out to First Rate.
Yeah, shout out First Rate. To have an album would be incredible. I'm finished business. Feels like, because also, you know, this is coupled, yeah, this romanticism that I'm having right now is coupled with how regularly I see you guys independently. Sure. It's coupled with I've just seen you do like a whole string of videos on your Instagram using all your analog stuff, which, oh my God, like, dude, how much outboard do you need?
That was actually an old video. That was done in 2017.
What?
Yeah. That's a slightly slimmer and more attractive version of myself.
You have got some mad outboard going on. And
well, it was a promo for Arturia, the drum machine at the time, it was an analog machine.
So what's the curly thing that's got? Cause just
it's a tape delay.
It's a tape delay?
Yeah, it's just a spacer cable with a top off. So you can see the snake of the analog tape.
That shit's incredible.
So that was, and then you can manipulate it in real time, and there was like a Sherman filter back. It's actually quite a kind of, I think it's a fairly concise setup, but it is a fair bit of kit. But yeah, Suresh,
it's like one box up, for one up, thing. Suresh, kind of Suresh, hold tight.
Yeah, he had this kind of vision for the look of the whole thing, and it was born out of the kind of the cap down battle in A-track thing where you can't really see me, and it's like double moody.
Yeah,
like, let's try and capture that. We'll make it dark, and
it worked.
Try and make it look like a BMW Gucci advert.
It fucking worked.
He smashed it. Yeah, so we did that. That was like a promo thing for Arturia, but we kind of, they were really accommodating in this, the vision of like, let's make it a pure analog thing. So using that 07 Pickles edition and
yeah, because that was classic. When I saw the mix, I was like, yeah, he's going back.
That was the quadraphonic one as well, the one was with the kind of the paddles on it. You could have a front and a rear output to it. It's like two mixers in one case.
That's cold.
Bonkers, man. Yeah. But yeah, see, 2017. I thought you were going to say about the top down shots of looping up the things on that Pioneer mixer.
But you also doing stuff with Flutebox, Lee. Hold tight, Nathan.
Oh yes, Nathan.
That was
of course,
fantastic.
Man. He was around yesterday, man. Yeah. Yeah, I love working with Nathan, man. Yeah, he's a wicked dude.
He's energy.
Yeah, and we're very quite similar people, so we'll get on like a house on fire.
Yeah, that's my guy.
Yeah, we're trying to take it down a slightly more kind of contemporary route with the beats behind the flute and the two married together. Just
they do, yeah, yeah. They do. Just going back to what we were saying at the top of the episode, the idea of like formation, splitting, coming together, never and still even to this day has not been done in the way that you guys did it. Scratch Perverts did it back in the day. It's more accessible now to be able to do it. Surely, like you were saying, you know, you've amassed so much equipment. You've amassed a studio. You've amassed knowledge on the technical side of things. Then every other person within the crew have their own things going on.
Sure. For me personally, I feel like I've still got I want to get some releases out this year and do some more work as well, just as prime cuts. I've been talking to Will Bankhead, who runs Trilogy Tapes. One of my favourite record labels ever. We're looking to do a thing together, which I'm really excited about. I sort of send him like a down-tempo electro kind of burner tune that he's enthusiastic about. So I think we're going to do some good work.
That's wicked.
And with the rest of the guys, man, yeah, let's see if we can do something, man. Why not? I mean, me and Mark, we were meant to do a battle weapon together called Super Doody Tough Ones, but we just never got round to it. We're going to have K's one on the front.
Gold.
But it's I think I'm chatting with the rest of the guys, so we'll see, man.
Bring it fucking on. We won't get into too much detail that went on before the camera, but all I'll say is a lot of dreams are coming true for you at the moment, brother. Like, it's almost like, hey, give me some of that. Touch whatever you want in here, let it go gold.
Yeah, it's been a good week, a really good week. Yeah, trying to hopefully do a sort of a regular slot with Huey on Radio 6, BBC.
Yeah,
Radio
he said
6.
It.
It'd be, I mean, I'm at least doing a kind of classic hip hop mix for the show.
Mad.
In the kind of guise of that hip hop don't stop thing.
So, well, Huey Morgan, which is what radio station?
Radio 6.
Radio 6.
His show's on at 10:30 on Saturday. It's a really good. It's a great show. I listen to it. You know, I genuinely listen to it every single week. And
you're already in the team. Sort of you're already part of the team.
Yeah, man.
Well, that bit, Huey, when you do that bit, yeah, I fill in for that bit, yeah? None of them ones, isn't it?
But yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. That's going to be me for the next couple of weeks and building stuff for Bankhead. And yeah, let me know how you get on getting through to Paul.
Yeah.
How are the lads doing?
Yeah, that's the next embarkment, I think, to complete the set of eight. Trust me, it's a box set. And also, I'm going to say this now so that we do actually do it. We are going to do a mini doc, aren't we? We have to do a scratch.
Oh, yeah, yeah. My missus has been going through the press cuttings. I've kept, like, I've got boxes, two huge boxes all full of the press cuttings from 97, 98. Got that copy of The Face where we were voted DJs of the year.
John's got everything. So anyone out there that wants to get involved in that and help piece this whole tapestry of awesomeness together with us. That's the...
Yeah, just trying to kind of get it into some kind of order. Mm. She's doing a really great job, so everything is chronological.
She's doing
so,
it.
At the moment we've got to, I think we've filled two books, these massive presentation books. We've filled two, and we're still only in 98, I think. We still, and she was saying the press goes crazy in 2002. That's the one where there's loads of stuff. So it'd be a great thing for me and you to go through all that stuff, man. And I've got some amazing photos of us in that limousine going to New York in 99, man.
Actually, Neil told me about this. And I was like, oh, yeah, we did, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Bonkers.
Yeah, some very young faces in that car.
Yeah. Need that. I've got an audio tape of the John Peel.
Oh, right.
I've got it ripped as well. Big up people documents.
If you could fire it to me, yeah, mate, that'd be amazing. I have not heard that since the show.
Yeah, it's bonkers.
There was like an anniversary of his passing, and they played a little clip of him saying, introducing us.
Yeah, I've got it.
Mate, I'd love that. Yeah,
I've got you. It's there. It's been converted. It's there. Because I knew we were going to do this, and it'll be
wicked.
So sick, wouldn't it?
Wicked.
All these pieces all put together.
Yeah.
In a timely, you know, nostalgic look at the history of the scratch. And before we sign out, I just want to say thank you. Because setting fires around here again. Listen, without you and your input and creative, you know, drive and belief in me from the beginning, I just definitely would not be here, certainly wouldn't be here chatting to you.
So that's lovely, man.
Thank you
that's
so
lovely.
Much, my brother.
That's
hip-hop through and through.
Thank you very
Joel,
much.
Joel, man, you know, just anybody, the Hip-Hop Award UK starts with this guy right here.
I'll try not to destroy your table.
Sorry, it's not a table. That's why it's...
it's just a floating...
It is. You know that Alan Partridge? Whoa! It's that table. Listen, thank you so much. Prime Cuts inside the place. Come on. Scratch
thank
perverts,
you.
Yeah? And if you didn't check one of the 159 shows that him, Tony and Neil did, part plus one did, then, yo, you missed out, man. Until the next time, big up yourself.
Awesome. Thanks, man.
Yeah, you know what it is, Killer Cutter Podcast, sharing is caring, sharing and all that. All right, don't talk to anyone I wouldn't. Stay lucky, people. Peace.